This is an IEEE Computer Society podcast. I'm David Alan Greer, and this is In Our Time. While high technology has done much to help us manage our days and weeks, it often meets special challenges when it faces immovable deadlines. This is the theme explored in the current podcast, which is entitled The Boundaries of Time. Jordan was the kind of speaker who could have made good use of a backup band. By training, he was an accountant, a small-town professor who sold his advice to the local business community. Yet, if he had wanted a career on stage, he would have found it for the asking. Jordan had a smooth, confident voice that commanded not only your attention, but also your acquiescence. He was able to use this voice to elevate business topics into subjects that touched on the great themes of mortal existence, good and evil, technical knowledge and human ignorance, uncertain success and incomplete failure. As you listened to Jordan's arguments, you could easily hear a band adding its contribution to the presentation. First, a high soprano voice would build a long, sustained note above the words. This would be followed by the crack of a drumstick, the rolling sound of an electric bass, and the harmony of a gospel choir, singing of salvation for all who sought truth righteously. "You trust these machines with your money," Jordan would intone. "You trust them with your health, with your career, and with your children." He would pause at critical moments to make sure that you grasped the full implication of his ideas. "You even trust them with your good name." "This is serious times for serious people," Jordan would say. "When the year 2000 arrives, the millennial bug is going to touch every aspect of your life. On that day, I would not fly in an airplane. I would not leave my money in a bank. I would not expect that any force on earth would be able to protect me from the chaos that is in the streets." During the late 1990s, Jordan had a ready audience for this presentation, an ever-changing collection of business leaders and computer professionals who were ready to be frightened by the potential evils of the millennial bug, or as it later came to be known, the Y2K problem. The technical roots of this problem were easy to understand. Many of the computer programs that were operating at the time recorded dates as a pair of digits, and hence were not able to keep track of the century. The year 1998 was represented as 98, which was also the representation for 1898, or 2098. Jordan could convince audiences that this abbreviated form of the date could cause any number of practical problems. "Social Security payments will stop," he prophesied, "because the recipients will suddenly become too young. Dangerous criminals will wrongly be identified as having served their sentences." Being a good prophet requires that you offer either a technical wonder or a moral lesson. Jordan did not understand enough programming to offer the solution, and he did not have a vision sufficient to extract the broader moral from the experience. All he could offer was the vague exhortation to be more diligent, advice that can be applied at almost any time to any computer project. Lacking a good backup band, Jordan soon found that his golden voice and his message of fear were not enough to hold an audience. As the days stepped towards the 31st of December, 1999, he found himself pushed further and further from the discussion of the Y2K problem. As we've begun to understand the full nature of the Y2K issue, we have rediscovered that each generation of programmers and engineers finishes its work with a balance sheet of assets and debts. Living in a world where deadlines are measured in the 18-month unit of Moore's Law, we work through this sheet in our own cycle of steps, attempting to turn each debt into a technical wonder. Like so many issues in computer science, the Y2K problem had its roots in the interface between the technical environment and the human world. Virtually all the early computers were designed around a clock, an electronic metronome that synchronized the operations of the different elements of the machine. All these clocks operated with little connection to civil time, to the world that humans lived in. They were hidden deep in the machine's hardware, and none were particularly accessible. Among the early computers, the clock of the 1946 ENIAC computer was perhaps the most visible, but it had a fundamental quirk that made it challenging to use. This clock was a collection of pulses that could be directed to any unit of the machine. It could be sent to an accumulator to record the seconds and hours of the day. However, if you attempted to read the clock, to extract the data from that accumulator, you would discover that your clock would miss a beat and would require a correction. The correction was not particularly difficult to make, but it required the careful attention of a programmer. Clearly, the best timekeeper among the early machines were the SAGE systems, the machines that had been designed to be part of the American Air Defense System and to follow events that occurred in the human world. Each SAGE machine had a vacuum tube clock that could keep time for 34 minutes and 8 seconds before it returned to zero and started counting again. By itself, this clock was not sufficient for the basic tasks assigned to the SAGE, tracking Soviet bombers over Alaskan airspace, coordinating fighter intercepts. But this clock could not be expanded without increasing the size of other machine elements, the data paths, the disk drives, the memory, the I/O channels. To turn this clock into a useful tool, software had to expand the boundaries of time for the SAGE. A decade passed before timekeeping became a common feature of general commercial systems. Even then, any effort to keep track of dates and times required both ingenuity and discipline. The IBM System 360, which was released in the leap year of 1964, had an internal clock that stored the date in 5 decimal digits. 3 digits were used to record the day, a number between 1 and 366 that year, or 365 in regular years. The remaining 2 digits were used to record the year. Nothing kept track of the century. In 1964, the end of the 20th century was far beyond the horizon of every computer designer. The age of electronic calculation was not yet 2 decades old. No computer had lived a useful life that exceeded a decade. If some engineers had thought about the turn of the century, they would have assumed that the machines of 1999 would be 4 or 5 generations removed from the machines of 1964, and that they would have capabilities far beyond those of the IBM System 360. Certainly, they would have expected that any problems of dates and centuries would have been solved long before then. Any complacency over the long years before the century's end was shaken in just 5 years, when the System 360 experienced a problem with its internal calendar. IBM technicians identified the source of the problem in the machine's operating system and told customers to circumvent the issue with a lie, the temporary return of the computer date to the 1st of January, 1969. By the end of the month, the programmers had corrected the problem and were able to return the System 360 to the common civil calendar. In 1980, as electronic computation moved into its 35th year, the computer industry began acknowledging, at least tacitly, that some of its creations, or their offspring, would be operating on the night of the millennial change. IBM, noting that its System 360 design had celebrated its 14th birthday and could plausibly celebrate 20 more, added a century bit to its representation of calendar dates. This new century bit was another short-term expedient, a solution that moved a current problem into the distant future. If any of the IBM engineers were concerned about drawing the wrath of the programmers who might face the calendar problem of 2099, they never wrote of it. perhaps like the original designers of the IBM System 360, they doubted that their handiwork would survive until that date. In the late 1980s, and even in the early 1990s, few individuals were thinking about the calendar problems of the year 2000, and fewer still were doing anything about it. Occasionally, a software engineer would discuss the problem at a conference, but these presentations often communicated an air of despair. If we recognize and fix the problem in our environment while the rest of the computing world ignores it, wrote one researcher in 1990, the problem will still affect everyone, including us. During the first years of the 1990s, only a handful of people talked about the potential problems that the computing technology would face at the turn of the century. Most of these individuals were business consultants, like Jordan. At the end of 1994, according to one survey, no more than 5% of all computer centers were preparing for a change of dates. As with so many issues in the modern world, the millennial bug became a public issue only when someone thought it proper to make a formal statement to the press. IBM took that step on the 16th of December, 1996, announcing that the Y2K problem would appear in all forms of information technology and that this problem could be addressed through services provided by IBM. Although the price tag for making systems year 2000 ready could be high, the statement proclaimed, failure to act will adversely affect a broad array of commercial, industrial, educational, and government operations. The news of the Y2K problem generated some concern among the public. However, most individuals were more puzzled than frightened. It seems odd, editorialized the New York Times, that in an industry that is downright apostolic about the future, no one saw the millennium coming until it was just this close. Many observers suggested that the world's computers could be saved by lying about the change in the calendar, the same solution that had restored the IBM System 360 computers three decades before. One clergyman, expressing disenchantment with modern life, argued that such an adjustment to the calendar would correct the ills wrought by the 20th century. He said that we would avoid countless genocides, the Holocausts, and two atomic bombings. Furthermore, he wrote, it buys us another century in which to fix the millennial bug. Predictably, a lie told twice loses some of its credibility in the second telling. The adjustment that allowed IBM engineers to address problems with the System 360 in 1969 would not be as effective in 1999. Over the prior 30 years, computers had become increasingly interconnected. They were part of systems that passed messages from machine to machine. The simple lie about the date would completely disrupt these flows. The system that drew the greatest concern from the public was the network of computers that controlled airplane traffic. They should not be used beyond December 1999, stated one report, because they may not operate reliably when the date rolls over to the 1st of January 2000, and there is no way to predict the effect on air traffic. The air traffic machines had to conglomerate data from multiple radar installations, which were scattered across thousands and thousands of square miles. At the same time, they had problems with their own internal operations. In a test that advanced the date temporarily to the 1st of January 2000, many of these machines were unable to control even their own cooling systems properly. Much of the strategy to fix the Y2K problem followed the standard cycle of quality engineering. Identify the problem, create a solution, test the solution, deploy the solution, repeat. The only special aspect of this problem was the fact that the deadline of the 31st of December 1999 was immovable. Commonly, computer centers began their preparation for the December 31st deadline by intending that they would modify their old programs and recode their databases. As these organizations learned the scope of the problem, many decided that they would be better served by replacing old systems with new ones. As the deadline loomed, a few writers suggested that the best protection against Y2K problems would be to change companies rather than systems. One wrote that it would be best to merge with or to buy a company that has Y2K safe systems, and then retire your own. The effort to beat the millennial deadline proved costly. One estimate found that $3 trillion was spent by American firms. Some complained that the money was ill-spent. Some argued that it could have been avoided with careful application of those fundamental engineering principles: evaluate, design, test, deploy, repeat. At the same time, many companies felt that last December of the 20th century, they faced a new world with a better understanding of their old systems. Having come through the Y2K problem, they understand what they were managing. One consultant argued that his client now had both a baseline and a systematic methodology available to evaluate and improve its computer systems. Here, I will confess that I carried a flashlight when I walked down to the Washington Mall to see the fireworks at midnight on the 31st of December, 1999. I was fairly certain that nothing would happen at midnight. I had long ago dismissed the words, but I wasn't entirely confident. The sky was dark, and I didn't want to pick my way home through unlit streets without a source of light. All our fears were put to rest when the Washington Monument lit up at midnight and nothing happened. We cheered, we hugged, pleased to witness the change of the calendar and grateful that the plague of Y2K problem had passed us by. 3 or maybe 4 days later, I was at the National Academy of Sciences Library, chatting with a staff member about the change of the year. "Our copier has the Y2K problem," says the attendant. "He was behaving oddly this morning," she said, "so I changed the date. And the machine completely stopped." I looked at the machine and saw a technician replacing a part and thought of Jordan. "Is that true?" I asked. "Was it Y2K? "Sorta," he said. "We've had some trouble with the software during the past week that might be Y2K, but this copier came to a halt only when the staff member changed the date. Disrupted the billing program. The copier company likes to be paid." The copier had passed through the boundary of time then with little difficulty. I was only grateful that I saw the technician working on that old engineering cycle: evaluate, design, test, deploy, repeat. You've been listening to In Our Time. This podcast was based on an essay published in the July 2007 issue of Computer. The music for the show came from the Podshow PodSafe Music Network. You can find it at music.podshow.com. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time.